Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So I'm excited to be joined today by Dr. Kenny Bailey from the Bailey Lab in Edinburgh, who is a deep expert in many areas of genomic healthcare and how that relates to different critical conditions and others. Kenny, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
And your Twitter profile describes you as an intensive care doctor who tries to understand critical illness using genomics. Tell us a little bit about how you went on the journey to be in this space today.
Well, I think what started me off in genomics was the idea that we really don't understand the problems that patients face in critical care. I think my clinical specialty, intensive care medicine, is behind other medical specialties in that we are still at the level of grouping patients into syndromes, so they look similar to each other, rather than diseases, which is what we call a medical problem when we think we understand what's causing it. So I personally think that genomics has a great deal to offer to give us clues about the biology that underlies those problems.
And before you got into intensive care medicine, what was it that inspired you to get into the field of healthcare or medicine at all when you were maybe a kid or a teenager?
Oh, that's a question for me 23 years ago. I have only a hazy recollection. I think if you can remember your teens, you weren't really there. I wanted to do something useful, and I like science. And I think probably, if I'm being really honest, my thinking on the matter didn't go much deeper than that. And I think probably, most 17-year-olds probably make decisions on a similar basis. So medicine seemed like a useful way to contribute, and it's a very interesting topic. And then, having got into a medical program, there are various bits of medicine that really, really captured my imagination, and from then I was hooked.
Fantastic. I thought for a second that you were going to say, I made the decision because the girl that I fancied decided to become a doctor, and so I thought I'd follow.
It was the decision that led me to the girl that I fancied. I met my wife at university, so it all worked out very well.
Excellent. And once you'd got into medicine, you started studying physiology. And as far as I understand, you did some pretty interesting work around high altitude and the effect that that has on the body. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. So I really loved the physiology of the heart and lungs. I think organs that move where you can see they're doing something had an attraction for me. And I think it's a source of regret to me that most of the physiology to really understand how those organs work was completed in the 20th century by giants of the field like Arthur Guyton and Starling and Severinghouse. And I think if I'd had my pick of any area to study, it would have been, understanding how gas gets exchanged in the lungs or how blood flows around the body. But those problems are, or those bits of physiology are really relevant to how the body adapts to physiological extremes such as high altitude, and it was really the physiology that got me interested in altitude medicine, and I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to do some high altitude research when I was a medical student, and I've sort of continued that as a hobby ever since then.
And what counts as high altitude? I'm a keen hiker of the hills of Scotland, but do they count as high altitude, or where do you have to go to study this?
So you can get a bit more breathless on the summit of Ben Nevis than you could at sea level if you were to exercise there. But I don't think that really counts. When I was in one of those incredibly long summer holidays you get when you're a student, I was very lucky to be able to travel to Bolivia. And there I met some physicists who ran a high altitude telescope. And I asked them if we could come there with a bunch of other students to study adaptation to high altitude. And the telescope's on a mountain called Shakotaya at an altitude of 5,200 metres. So for context, Everest is 8,848 metres. At 5,200 metres, there's a roughly half as much oxygen in a breath as there is at sea level. So it's a pretty significant change to your physiology.
Wow. And so how did you go from there to studying the impact of genomics on the body, so how the DNA is affecting the outcomes that patients see?
So in my case, that was not a logical step. So I really enjoyed high altitude physiology, did a fair amount of research with a wonderful group of people for the first sort of 10 years of my medical career, alongside medical training, which of course takes a great deal of time and energy. And then I was very lucky to get a job on a new academic training programme in Edinburgh, which is called ECAT. And that was led by two people called John Iredale and Brian Walker, who had the idea that in order to train the next generation of medical scientists, they would appoint them to what they called cradle-to-grave funding. So I was, at the age of 30, I was still, in their view, in the cradle. And they gave us a year of, you know, having a day a week to go around the city and look for supervisors for a PhD, and then a Wellcome Trust-funded PhD and support afterwards, right up until completing training as a consultant. And it was that opportunity that allowed me to really think outside what I'd already been focusing on and look for where the best opportunities were to make a difference. And in my case, I think that was genomics.
In your case, you've focused on critically ill people in a range of different contexts. That must be tough in terms of the human side of that. How did you get into that, and how do you think about doing that kind of work and helping people in that kind of situation?
Well, again, I think there probably was more thought went into that than there was to the decision to go to medical school. Physiology is at the very core of critical care medicine, so that was a logical move for me based on my background. But really, I had my first experience working in intensive care in 2002, and that was shortly after leaving medical school when I was a junior doctor, and I just loved it. The ability to spend more time than you usually would in other specialties on one patient, to really understand their disease, to have the time and resources to really focus on what you can do to save that one person, which of course is necessary for patients who are critically ill, because in almost all cases their lives are on the line. So I find that very enjoyable, and it's tremendously rewarding to interact with people at such a difficult time in their lives. And that goes for the patients, who are often desperately sick and in many cases unable to communicate, but also their relatives, who are often present, actually. And, you know, for all of my career, apart from 2020, dealing face-to-face with relatives has been, you know, a very big part of my job. And it's, although it's very emotionally exhausting, it's tremendously rewarding to help people through one of the most difficult times in their lives.
Absolutely. And so help us just understand the link to genomics. So someone's in intensive care, they're very sick, maybe they've had an accident of some kind, maybe they've got some kind of other critical condition. How does what's going on in their DNA influence their outcomes in intensive care?
An intensive care unit is a place where we provide organ support. So we support the function of organs that are failing. And that happens in patients who are desperately sick for one of the reasons that you listed. About 40% of them have an infection. So broadly, we call those sepsis, a condition in which the body's immune response to an infection causes damage to the organs and causes them to fail. And other conditions like trauma, after major surgery, people sometimes become desperately sick or need to be cared for in intensive care, pancreatitis, a few other conditions. So what unifies all these patients is the need for support. And in about 70% of cases, patients need support for their breathing with a mechanical ventilator. And usually those people are in a medically induced coma with a machine breathing for them. So that's the group of patients we're looking after. Now, in that group, there are physiological processes that are causing harm to their body. And we know that those processes are driven in part by the host immune system. Your own immune system damages your organs. The best example is sepsis, where we know that what sets it off is an infection, but we also know from decades of research in animal models and other studies that the damage to the organs is actually caused by your own immune system. So it's collateral damage of your immune system fighting the infection, if you like. Now, the problem there is that we don't know how to switch it off. We can't just turn off the whole immune system because you need to fight the infection. And you know, we've tried that and it doesn't make people better. In fact, we've tried many things to suppress different components of the host immune response to infection to try to make people better in sepsis. And I think this is probably the best test of our understanding of the disease, how many of our attempted treatments are actually successful. So one of my collaborators, John Marshall, counted the clinical trials we've done in sepsis in the last 30 years. He counted 121 clinical trials, and these are all what we call phase 2 and 3 trials, so each of them would cost tens of millions of pounds. And no one embarks on a clinical trial without really thinking that that treatment works. And out of those 121 trials, literally none of them found that the treatment benefited the patients. So I think that shows that we just don't get it, right? Our understanding of the molecular mechanisms of the disease that we're treating is not sufficient.
And that's where the genomics can help us to understand what might be a better candidate to intervene in that context?
So yes, so this is a theory. I think we have now shown this to be true in the context of COVID, but really only in the last 2 months. And until then, it's been a hypothesis that maybe the genome can help us here. But I think the real beauty of using genetics to tackle that problem is that we can look across the entire genome, which of course encodes the entire immune system. So we can look at the raw source code of the immune system and ask what changes in that code make a difference to your chance of living or dying once you have an infection. And of course, the fundamental thing that we are lacking is exactly that knowledge. We don't know what levers we need to push in the immune system to change its function in order to improve our patient's chance of surviving. And my hope is that genetics can lead us to those levers.
You describe this work in critical care as being both emotionally exhausting and incredibly rewarding. What methods have you developed to help engage with people in such challenging circumstances, explain these complex scientific ideas to them, and I guess kind of get them involved in what you're doing?
Well, so there are a few different groups of people that we interact with. So I suppose the first are patients and their relatives who we invite to participate in research studies. So the research study that I've been running for the last 5 years is called Genomic, Genetics of Mortality in Critical Care. And I'm now delighted that we're running that study in partnership with you and Genomics England. That study requires a single DNA sample and a few bits of clinical information from a patient. And that simple contribution can make a colossal difference to our understanding of disease. We present that to patients and their relatives, as obviously it's a pure research study. It has no potential to benefit the patient themselves, you know, during the course of their illness. They're sick right now, and what we're trying to do is discover treatments that might help in the future. So we explain that there is potential for genetics to help us understand this disease, and that our understanding of it is limited. And it's really encouraging how often people respond with great enthusiasm to that and are very keen to contribute, even though the study has no potential benefit to them. We have very few people who decline to contribute to the study. The other group of people that I've interacted with, which has also been extremely rewarding in a different way, is members of the public who have raised research money to study critical illness or sepsis. So there's a group called the Fiona Elizabeth Agnew Trust, which have funded our study for several years now. They're a charity that were founded by a man called Craig Stobel after his wife, Fiona Elizabeth Agnew, died from sepsis in 2012. And she was a healthy young woman who tragically got a nasty infection and died of sepsis in intensive care. And Craig and her friends and many others whose lives have been touched by sepsis came together to raise money to support research. And at a critical point in the history of our study, when we didn't have much money, we had great ideas, but not enough money to establish the study across the large area that we needed to really make a difference. Craig and the other members of the charity had faith in us, decided that this is something that they wanted to contribute their hard-earned money to, in the full understanding that, you know, we thought it was a good idea, we thought it might make a difference, but it could take a long time. And, you know, I've been saying to them from the start that it could take 10 years before we find something that even looks like it might be useful. They have really thrown their support behind me. And meeting them and hearing their, you know, the stories of loved ones that they've lost and seeing their dedication to solving this problem is just a really great experience for me as a scientist, because it really focuses my mind on solving problems that matter to them and not getting distracted by, you know, other aspects of the science.
Are there things that you've learned from that experience and those conversations that you think are relevant about how researchers, doctors and clinicians, policy officials, other people should think about engaging with the public on these topics around genomics? You know, there's so much to unpack there around data privacy and how the data is used, research and the ethics of that, how research gets translated into clinical care. What lessons should we take away from those experiences?
Well, I think the main lesson is always to involve the public and patients in research. And that sounds obvious, but it's actually, you know, you're sitting in front of your desk about to write a research grant proposal or a paper or do some analysis. The obvious immediate thing to do is just to get on and do it. And, you know, if you're a scientist, you know how to do that and you know what you want to do. I have never had any engagement with the public about my research that I have regretted. It's always enriching in some way and usually very significantly. So I make a point of discussing my research wherever I can. You know, you might expect that things like the whole direction of the research and the focus on finding treatments and having an impact on people's lives might be where public engagement really pushes me, and of course it does. But there are also specific components of the design of clinical studies that I've undertaken that have come directly from patients that have actually improved the science. And that's partly just the way that explaining a research plan to lay people forces you to really think it through. And it's partly, you know, the ingenuity and insight coming from the patients themselves.
That's fantastic. And let's get down to brass tacks for a second. So I'm a researcher writing my grant proposal. Maybe let's, for the sake of argument, say I'm a little bit shy. I'm maybe a bit nervous about just going out to a street corner and standing on a soapbox and kind of discussing my research with passers-by. Who should I reach out to? What are the channels? How can we best actually do this engagement?
Clinicians don't tend to have that problem because we often keep in touch with our patients. So that's actually less common in critical care, where, you know, people recover, they're still a bit groggy from their critical illness, and then we discharge them to the wards and sometimes don't see them again. So it takes a wee bit more effort to keep in touch with patients after intensive care. But most clinicians, of course, see their patients in outpatient clinics and very regularly. So they're in touch with them all the time. If you're a scientist who doesn't directly interact with patients, I think there are two ways to do that. Probably the best is to work with a group of clinicians, because, you know, sometimes those interactions have challenges, but I think in most cases they're based on mutual respect, and that's a great way to really develop an understanding of the clinical problems and to open a dialogue with patients. The other way to do it in the UK is through the National Institute for Healthcare Research. Or other professional societies, like in intensive care medicine, the Intensive Care Society, who provide extraordinary, deep and thoughtful engagement with patients. The NHR is a fantastic organisation that serves to facilitate clinical research in the NHS, and they have specific programmes to help researchers engage with patients. In Scotland, the Chief Scientist Office can provide similar things, and individual hospital research support offices are also able to do that.
So more recently, with you mentioned the work of Genomic in response to COVID. Give us a sense of how that research is working and what impact it's having so far.
Okay, so we now have discoveries, which I think is a really exciting time. So I've been saying for, you know, coming on for a decade, you know, give us your research money and we might find something useful. Well, for the first time, we really have, because by recruiting across the whole UK, 5,400 people now with critical illness caused by COVID, we've been able to compare their genomes with the rest of the population. Now, that's a colossal effort. It depends on the NIHR, a huge network of research nurses, the patients themselves, of course, and a big central coordinating team here in Edinburgh, and our friends and collaborators in Genomics England and Illumina, who are doing whole genome sequencing on these patients. But having done that, we compared the genomes of the first 2,000 patients with the general population. So we asked the question, what is it that's genetically different about critically ill patients with COVID-19 compared to the rest of the population of the UK? And we found 5 points on the genome where there were really strong differences that stand out above all of the noise that you get when you compare people's genomes. One of them was already known, the other 4 were completely new. And they led us, in 3 cases, they led us directly to drugs. How that works is that the genome is the code that defines what happens in your body. So it encodes every messenger and mediator in your immune system. And we have some understanding of how that code works. And in the first results from Genomic in COVID, we got lucky. And the signals that we saw are right next to genes that encode proteins whose function we know something about. In the case of one of them, for example, it's called TYK2, tyrosine kinase 2. There's already a drug that inhibits that protein. We showed that inhibiting that protein is likely to be the direction in which we need to move it in order to improve outcome. And that class of drugs, they're called JAK inhibitors, was already under consideration for treatment of COVID-19. So that takes us, you know, in a heartbeat, straight from a genetic observation to prioritising a treatment for use in a clinical trial.
Which is super inspiring. And some of those results, as you say, have fed directly into the clinical trials. They've also been briefed to the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, SAGE. What was it like, just as a human moment, briefing some of those findings into this central government machinery?
Well, that was very exciting and encouraging. There's tremendous enthusiasm from the members of SAGE for the results from Genomic. People have been waiting for clues exactly like this since the beginning of the outbreak. We've had literally hundreds of drugs on the table available to us that will target the immune system to try to stop lung damage in COVID. And really, very little hard evidence on which to base the decision about which one to use next. And genetics really does lead us, it gives us very strong evidence to prioritise some of those drugs above others. I've had an interest in outbreak medicine and respiratory disease for some time, so I know personally many members of the current SAGE cohort, because of course it's a relatively small field, so some of my old friends were there.
Always reassuring to have some friends in the crowd. That is great. And as we're thinking through, we can see the impact that this study of how does the genome influence the body to then respond in different ways to different illnesses, different stimuli. So we can see the impact that this science is having. As it starts to move more and more into the mainstream, what for you are the questions we need to ask ourselves, the pitfalls we need to watch out for as these techniques become more part of our lives?
Well, I think the immediate pitfalls are going off in the wrong direction from a genetic signal. The primary reason for doing this right now, urgently in 2020 for COVID, is that we want to find treatments. And so, as I said, we think that, you know, the signals are right next to protein coding genes that we understand. There is a possibility, there's always a possibility that the signal is actually mediated, the effect is actually mediated through a different mechanism. So we have to be aware of that. And, of course, any suggested treatment has to go into a randomised clinical trial. It's the only way we'll ever know what really works in medicine. There are always surprises, so we have to test everything. And that's something actually that we've done extremely well in the UK in COVID-19 through the recovery trial. I think as we progress, you know, in the next decade or two into a world where genome sequence data is more widely available, and we see people presenting to a hospital where we have their genome as part of the diagnostic information that we have about them, there are really tremendous challenges in understanding the effect on diagnostic probability that a given genetic variant has, because as you know, there are many genetic variants in all of us that look like they're damaging but actually probably don't do very much. So, on average, there are about 200 variations in my genome that are completely unique to me, and the same is true for everybody else. And some of them are in the middle of genes that might well be implicated in a given disease process. So making use of that information in an informed way is really it's going to be a whole new field in medicine. And fortunately, I think we've got a bit of time to get our heads around that before, certainly in critical care medicine, before genome sequence data becomes normal. And in the meantime, there's tremendous immediate discovery potential, particularly for specialties like mine that are maybe a bit behind in understanding disease mechanisms, where genomics can really teach us a great deal about the diseases that we treat, not just for the patients with genetic variants, but for everyone.
That's great. And as we're talking to more people about these topics, what questions would you ask other people in all walks of life, from religious leaders to business leaders to community members, all sorts of people? What would you want to know about what people are thinking about or worried about genomics?
There are a great number of very general questions, like what are your attitudes to the privacy of your genetic information? As you know, we now have tremendous capacity to actually edit the genome of living cells and organisms, which is inevitably going to become widespread in the next decade or two. What the ethical limitations are and how we test and use those sorts of technologies will be, very important discussions to have openly with the public. I think the public understanding of genomics is going to improve quite drastically. I think the public understanding of critical care medicine has improved quite drastically in the last year. So the union of those two, I hope, will be productive.
Kenny, thank you so much for the time today. Thank you for everything that you're doing with us and independently in the war against COVID. It's making a real difference, and it's very inspiring stuff.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.